In this episode, we are going to be talking about Stage Fright from 1950, directed by Alfred Hitchcock. This one stars Jane Wyman and Marlena Dietrich. My guest today is Norman Buckley. He is an award-winning director whose credits include Pretty Little Liars, Charmed, In the Dark, Zoo, Quantico, Rizzoli and Isles, Chuck, Gossip Girl, and The OC. He was co-executive producer slash producing director on Sweet Magnolias and Pretty Little Liars, The Perfectionists, and he recently was a speaker at the Hitch Conference, where I spoke just last month. Norman, welcome. I'm so glad that you could join me today to talk about this underrated gem.
Thank you for asking me. I'm happy to be here.
You've had such an impressive career. I mean, just looking at, you know, as an assistant director, worked on Tender Mercy, Silkwood, Places in the Heart.
As an assistant editor. I was an assistant editor on those films.
Sorry, assistant editor. So many great filmmakers. Mike Nichols, a lot of my favorites, actually. You know, you had mentioned that you had learned everything so much about filmmaking from, you know, Hitchcock himself. I know that's like that's a lot to tell in a podcast. So is there a few things you'd like to share that stick out the most to you in terms of that, what you really learned from him?
Sure. I think that, I read the Hitchcock Truffaut book when I was 11. I bought it at a bookstore when it came out in the United States in 1967. And I was mesmerized by it. I saw it at a bookstore, took my parents down to the bookstore and said, I'd like to buy this book. And my dad was really against it. He was like, I think that's a waste of money. I don't know why you'd want that book, et cetera. And just to prove my father wrong, I essentially committed the book to memory. I read it over and over and over again when I was growing up. I didn't even know why. There wasn't even a desire at that point to work in the movie business or anything like that. But strangely enough, as we were driving back from the bookstore after I'd bought it, my mother was trying to lighten the mood because my dad wasn't happy about it, that I'd gone ahead and defied him and bought it because I had my own money. But my mother was kind of like, who knows, maybe Norman will grow up someday and work in the movie business. And so it was almost one of those things like, my unconscious knew what I was moving towards before even my conscious mind did. But the thing that I think I learned most from Hitchcock is the idea of always thinking in terms of the screen image being filled with emotion, right, and always looking for the aspect of what you're trying to portray visually to have the most emotional impact. And so, for instance, whenever I talk to my students, I teach occasionally at UCLA, or whenever I have any kind of input with new directors that on shows where I'm producing, I always say that you want to be able to tell the story in such a way that you could turn down the sound and still understand the emotional line of the story. And that's something that I really feel like I learned from Hitchcock. Certainly that was my experience watching his films when I was growing up, which was the thing that led me to be so interested in the book in the first place. But he really breaks it down in that book with Truffaut, the process of making a film and what's important. And I see it there behind your head on your bookcase.
Yes, right.
It's the book I recommend to anybody who's just beginning in the film business. I just think it's a primary text for anybody who really wants to be a filmmaker. And certainly, as you know, there are many, many filmmakers who are currently working who hold that book sacrosanct. You know?
Yes, so. Yes. It's one of the film Bibles, so to speak. Do you remember, even before reading that book, were you already interested in his movies, or did you?
Yes, I was. I'd seen several of his films on television, and even to the point where I would see something in the TV guide that was coming up. Like, I remember the first time I saw Rebecca, it was playing on the late show at, you know, 2 in the morning. And I asked my parents if I could wake up and watch it. And they were like, sure, knock yourself out. So I would get up and watch these movies. I don't know exactly why, and I don't know exactly when. I do know that his TV show was very popular when I was a child.
Right.
I'm sure that there was some degree of that informing my interest in his films. But the film I remember the most from my childhood, and which remains my favorite Hitchcock film, it remains my favorite film, is Rear Window. And I remember seeing that clearly when I was a child. I remember it very, very specifically from when I first saw it as a child. And then it was out of circulation for many, many years. And the next time I saw it, I saw a bootleg print when I was a student at the University of Southern California. There was a screening one night. It was a very scratchy 16 millimeter print, but the theater was overflowing because it was such an impossible film to see. And then, of course, when it was re-released in the 80s, I think I've probably seen it over 50 times at least. I just recently bought my 96-year-old mother a 65-inch television, and that was nice. The first thing we watched on it. We sat down, and I said, let's watch Rear Window.
Yeah, let's do this right.
it was great because 65-inch is a pretty big screen, and yeah. You can really see things that, I hadn't remembered. So some of the details in that film are just flawless. So, so that's I do remember Hitchcock from very early in my life.
Oh,
and
wow.
And really fascinated with him, fascinated again, not even totally understanding why. I think in retrospect, I was really responding to some aspect of the really deep psychological ideas that he explores in his films,
right.
Which I think is I think that he tried to portray himself as just an entertainer. I think that was kind of the party line, but he was an artist who was really trying to get at the real nature of how we behave as human beings, and I think that that runs throughout his work and is fascinating. And all of his films can really be dissected psychologically. And I think that's one of the things I enjoy most about watching his films.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. And I mean, this film, Stage Fright, is certainly one of them. And before we started recording, you had mentioned how you felt that this was a really underrated film that a lot of people perhaps haven't even heard of, unless you're a big Hitchcock fan. So I'm curious, what are your feelings in general on this film, and have they evolved at all in repeat viewings over the years?
Well, it's a film that he himself was somewhat dismissive of, but I actually think it's one of his films that I like the best. I love the theatrical milieu of it. I love the fact that it's really about people playing it being one thing, and yet they're really another. I think that a lot of the themes that he explored in many of his later films, you kind of see him wrestling with some of that stuff in this film. I enjoy it. I think the script is really clever. I think he came to believe that he made a mistake about the flashback in the beginning. The fact that the murderer is basically, they're showing a flashback in which he, is telling a lie. I think, he talked about having problems with that, but if you read Patrick McGilligan's biography, it was really his wife and Whitfield Cook who wrote script. They were the ones that had problems with that, and he was like, I want to do it this way, which I think is a really bold and interesting choice, because he's the he at least initially is the focus of her romantic ideas. And so in a certain sense, it even prefigures a film like Vertigo, because she is projecting onto him these, the Jane Wyman character, Eve Gill, is projecting onto
Johnny was his name, Richard Todd.
Yeah, she's projecting onto him a version of him that she would like to see, as right. opposed to seeing him for who he really is. And I just think it's a very interesting psychological story of her journey.
Yes.
Projecting onto the love object. And then as the movie goes on, she becomes focused on this other guy. I think it's a very interesting structure. And there's just a lot of playing with the idea of identity and what is identity and who's who they say they are.
Yeah.
Nobody in this movie, they're all playing at being something else. Even the detective character doesn't tell her that he's a detective until well into their first encounter. You know, everybody is playing at being something else, and right. everybody is existing in the space of their persona. And this was made in 1950, and you can really see in the films of the late 40s and into the 50s, Hitchcock's real interest in psychology and the real idea of the persona and hiding behind a certain version of your personality that you would like people to see, and then through the crux of experience. A metamorphosis happening, some type of change. The thing I love about his films is that his characters always go through some major change, some major right. growth, some major psychological growth. In many of the films, and I think the films from the 40s and the 50s are my favorites. But even as far back as the 39 steps, you really see a psychological progression yes. in these characters. You see characters going from being shallow to having more depth. You see characters really wrestling with some type of external experience that forces an internal catharsis, and that's why I think the films are viewable over and over and over again. I feel like that even the Marlene Dietrich character is basically portraying herself one way, and yet she's something else behind the scenes. I love that character. I love her dialogue. I love the fact that she never calls the woman who's assisting her the same name twice. Yeah. She's always calling her something else.
Which plays into the humor, because again, everyone's playing a role and she can't even get this woman's name right, but what she thinks her name is not even her name, if that makes sense. It really is wonderful, and I'm glad you brought up the flashback, because I liked it a lot too, and I was surprised that him and Truffaut both felt it was like a cardinal sin, so to speak, on cinema to have a flashback be a lie. But I think, why not? Because it really made you suddenly see Johnny, as you said, in a totally different light, because I'm feeling sorry for this guy the whole time. I'm feeling like he's a victim. And then in everything that I'm seeing it through Jane Wyman's eyes as the mm-hmm. film is. And then you realize in the end that he is not what you think. And then it makes you think is anyone what you think. Mm-hmm. And even when you see Dietrich in that flashback, I was suspicious that perhaps this was a lie on her part, mainly because sending him to get the dress, I mean, he was so emotional and was easily manipulated by her. Like, I just thought, just bring, go to the store and get another dress. But I could see how he would fall for that. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really, really clever. But her part, you're right. I mean, even in the end, I like that little speech she had with the police
wonderful.
Watching her. Oh, it's great.
It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. I had forgotten about that until I watched the film again last night, and I thought, oh God, this by itself is just so beautifully constructed, and I think the script is wonderful.
I agree,
it's hard to know like who wrote what, but Ranald McDougall worked on it, who wrote Mildred Pierce, who's I think just a really consummate screenwriter from the 1940s. Whitfield Cook worked on it, Almo Ravel worked on it, James Bridie worked on it. So who knows
Yeah, it's hard to say, but especially back then they worked like someone might be work, like just reading Joan Harrison's book recently. And as you know, she co-wrote a lot of his scripts with Alma as well. And they would be working together and they'd be on the phone with the other writer giving notes. And it's hard to know, right? You know, whose idea was whose. But
I thought that it was a very clever script, though. And I think a lot of the subtleties of it. I love the subtleties of the relationship between the parents, the idea that they have this alienated relationship and yet they're still married. But there's all this unspoken stuff that goes on. I just thought the film is full of wonderful, wonderful character developments, and then also beautiful frames, just gorgeous shots.
Yeah.
And beautiful long sequences where there are no cuts. The sequence where Marlene Dietrich comes to Richard Todd's apartment for the first time, there's a long unbroken sequence where they move all the way across the room and all the way back again, and there are no cuts in it. It's just beautifully staged.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people, you know, they talk about Rope as being like, oh, you know, these uninterrupted takes. And yet that was just the first time that he was experimenting with that. And I actually think Rope is not nearly as successful as Under Capricorn and Stage Fright in terms of these long unbroken takes that really do, that are seamless, that are actually showing you a lot. And there are no cuts in it. And it's so elegantly done. And I think it's worth studying just from that point of view alone.
Yeah.
I just think it's a masterclass in blocking in terms of how you move people through the frame and how you make it dramatic and how you use the cameras in a master shot, and then it's in a two shot, and then it's in a single, and then goes back to a master shot again. I mean, it's just beautifully, beautifully done.
Yeah.
And it's never talked about. This film is never talked about. And yet much more, as far as I'm concerned, this film is a much more interesting film than Rope is, for example. I think Rope is really kind of very stagey when you get right down to it. But this film, I think, has got just a lot of very cinematic moments. The sequence where he goes to Charlotte Inwood's house and he comes off the street and he goes in and he shuts the door behind him and then he goes all the way up the staircase. That's one uninterrupted shot.
And
when you think about during the time that they did that, they didn't have Steadicam.
They didn't have the
kind of tools that we have now to do those kinds of shots. It's remarkable.
Yeah.
And yet no one really talks about this film from that point of view. And again, it's just under the radar. And I think part of it is because Hitchcock was dismissive of it himself, which is, you know, too bad, because I feel that he enjoyed it more than I read between the lines of some of the interviews with Truffaut, where I feel like Truffaut is saying, you know, well, I like the first three reels of it, and then I feel like it goes off the rails, and he's like, oh, I don't know, you know, I really like the whole garden party. I think that sequence is very successful, and I think it harkens back to some of his British films in terms of its mix of humor and
yes, absolutely,
black comedy, and I think that. I don't know. I just don't get why people don't talk about this film more. It just, to me, it's just such an enjoyable film on so many levels.
I never get tired
of watching it. I never get tired of watching it. I watch it over and over again. I think there are things that I would do different. If I had my druthers, I would love to see that movie with a Bernard Herrmann score as opposed to the score it did have. I thought the score it did have was kind of neither here nor there.
I
was just imagining what it would feel like if Bernard Herrmann had scored it, and I certainly think it's got a lot of the same qualities as same qualities of humor as a film like The Trouble with Harry, and it's got a lot of the same kind of psychological elements as some of the films from the 40s, and it's got. I will agree with this. Hitchcock talked about the villains being weak in the fact that they were scared.
Right.
And I
right.
think that is a really great point. And that's something that I thought, oh, that really is something to think about, that you want your villain to be a formidable force, not somebody that's shrinking back and retiring. And I do think that there's that element of the narrative that probably could have been strengthened But I do think it's a remarkable film nonetheless, and I love the idea too of the examination of love and romance in it.
Right.
You know, that she has completely romanticized this guy.
Yeah.
And then she falls for this other guy, and just the nature of what that experience is. I think that the scene in the taxi where we're talking
that.
To each other. It was great. It was just great.
And that's when everything changes, right? Because
she's
that's where the humor played so well, because that's her opportunity to make him think that Marlene Dietrich was involved in the murder. And then, you know, they're looking at each other in a certain way, and they just begin to kiss. And then it's like, well, you know, when she tells her father later, you know, you just see he's like, I mean, he's so understanding, he's so patient. And even the father's motivation was very much motivated by, I mean, he warns his daughter, this is crazy. What are you getting yourself involved in? You can get in serious trouble for this, as you know, an accessory to murder or something. And, but then you don't know so much about the relationship with the parents. They're separated, but you feel that maybe he's been absent and this is his chance to, you know, help her and be there for her and go on a journey for her that perhaps he wasn't there before. That was the impression I got between the two of them. But they played so beautifully as well. Like even on the staircase when Johnny was there, and you know, he says to her, "Look, just so you know, he's actually wanted for murder." And she just says, "Well, now you've gone too far. You know, the next thing you're going to tell me is that guy today was a detective." And sure enough, he was, right? So I love that.
Yeah, the humor in it, I think it's just the movie is full of really very, very wonderful humor and really human characters. You know, I mean, this idea of that we, you know, even the idea that you would do this crazy scheme, who hasn't imagined that? Who hasn't imagined the idea that, like, oh, I'd love to get involved in solving a murder? I mean, the very fact that we're also fascinated with true crime stories on Netflix is evidence of that, you know, that we'd all love to kind of get involved with trying to track solve something, you know, the puzzle of it, the interest we have in mystery stories and all of that. I just think it's so well captured. Jane Wyman is good. You know, I think she's very good in the part. I think that, again, Hitchcock was critical of her because apparently she was moody and demanding on the set.
Insisted on makeup because she didn't look as glamorous as as Marlene Dietrich, which, and the irony is that was sort of the dynamic between them, because here she is in love with Johnny and Johnny's in love with Marlene Dietrich. So and at the same time, she's an actress in acting school at RADA, and Marlene Dietrich's the star, so she's jealous of her on a couple of different levels. And then interesting, behind the scenes it was a similar dynamic. And Marlene Dietrich, I just read, she didn't speak too highly of her in her memoir. She felt that she wasn't right for the part, that part, you know, she looks too much like a victim herself. But I thought that was part of the charm. I thought that it wasn't, you know, that it wasn't someone who looked like someone like Marlene Dietrich with a certain coldness and someone who's maybe perhaps you would trust as being capable. She looked like she has this nerdy, sweet quality to her. So it was interesting to go against that type of expectation.
I think she was great in the film. I think she was great.
I thought
great.
So too,
I think that, like, she really, and you know, it's interesting to note too that Hitchcock really insisted on that song, The Laziest Girl in Town.
Right.
He really insisted that song be used. She wanted to sing something else, and he was like, no, this is the song I really want to feature. And then that became part of her repertoire for the rest of her life. You know, that became that became one of the songs she was really known for, and that she always sang in concert. And again, to your point that Eve's character really wants to be in that position, and you see her watching from the wings. There's just so many beautiful, beautifully structured sequences in the film. And I love the whole, I've done a couple of episodes of television that have been shot in theaters. And I really use this film as a as a template. You know, it was one of the films that I would go back to and look at and show the writers that I worked with on various shows. Like, I'd like to do a show like this, or I'd like to really feature like that. And pulled stills and ideas from this film that I then used in other in TV shows that I directed. There's just so much I love about it. So yeah. You can tell I'm a fan.
No, absolutely. And just the one shot that I really loved that was on the stage was towards the end when she succeeds in, you know, having Dietrich caught, and then she's crying on the curtain, and you see her father like in the front row clapping as if it was like
wonderful. It's just wonderful. Yeah.
As if the whole thing was a performance, or like, here's the dad at opening night. But even at the top, like, he has the curtain rising, but it's the city. And again, it goes to that, the whole world's a stage is what I took from there, because as we already said, everybody is playing a role in this, or maybe even two roles. And they're also at the same time, two of them are professional actors, one being a student. It's so clever. But just looking back at that little speech that Marlene Dietrich has, I thought the fact that she starts to talk about her dog not loving her anymore, you couldn't help but think that she was talking about Johnny. And that, I think that just showed what a narcissist she was, to think that, like, you know, this person has let me down and will not go to jail for me, or will not, you know. I just thought that was so, you know, she mentioned something about her mother smacking her, you know, and obviously there's a hint that this woman maybe had a rough life or something along those lines. But I just love that, because I wasn't necessarily seeing her as someone who is narcissistic, because you're not quite sure where she sits in the film. I mean, you see that she's obviously guilty of plotting this, but then I thought that just added another whole other layer to who she was. But it's just such a strong performance from her. And just cinematically, as you said, at the end, when she also finds out that Johnny actually did this, and if I'm sure you saw, like, you can only really see their eyes. I mean, he had the shadows over there, and I was sort of mesmerized by the extreme close-ups. And it was almost scary. And at that point, because you see his hands start to clench as he may or may not kill her in that moment. But it was wonderfully emotional and power. I wonder why he chose. I don't know if you had any idea as to why perhaps he would have chosen to have those shadows. You just really saw those eyes.
Well, I think there's the aspect of just going for that kind of noirish sensibility. But I also think that, you know, what you asked me earlier, what were some of the things I've learned from Hitchcock as a filmmaker? The judicious use of close-ups, I think, is probably one of the things that I really carry with me, because so much of directing television is often, you know, you go on these shows where they just want close-ups on everything, and every line is in close-up, which then diminishes the power of a close-up.
Right.
And I think that one of the things that you really want to deliver in a close shot is that idea of really seeing the thought process inside a character's eyes. And so by shadowing the shots as he did, it even enhances that even more. Really go inside the character's head. She's basically learning that he's a murderer. He's basically really revealing the full extent of his psychoses. I think that there's probably just accentuating that by not featuring any element of the face but the eyes. And both of the actors, I think, really delivered in that moment.
I thought so too. Yeah, I thought so too. I don't know much about Richard Todd. I thought he was quite good in this. I don't know if you know his work, but
I don't really. I think I've seen him in one other thing. I know that he was nominated for an Oscar back in the 40s for a movie called The Hasty Heart. I never saw it. I think it was the same DP who worked on this. I don't know his work, but I do think he was quite good. Obviously, Michael Wilding from Under Capricorn, you know, and also he's famous for being Liz Taylor's second husband. And
I didn't know that.
Michael Wilding was married to Elizabeth Taylor.
I know that Dietrich said she had an affair with him on this, but I didn't know that he was married to her. That's interesting. Well, this has been a great, I've really enjoyed talking to you, Norman, about this film.
I'm delighted to have been asked. I have a real desire at this point in my life to champion things that I think people should see. And so I always like talking about something that's a little bit off the radar, because I do think that, everybody knows the famous films like Rear Window and Vertigo and The Birds, nobody needs to be pointed towards those. But I do think that Hitchcock's lesser known films are some of the most interesting,
I agree. I usually prefer his lesser known, like Under Capricorn and that we discussed. Not that I don't like the popular ones as well, but I do think they need to be sort of reassessed. Even Suspicion, I just recently saw, because I had the writer on recently who wrote the book on Joan Harrison. So we talked about Suspicion. Which she co-wrote, and I just thought that was, with the exception of the ending, which I know they were forced to make more happy, I thought that was a wonderful film. And I was like, this is another film that, is really much more complex relationship psychologically between the two the two characters. But for whatever reason, people perhaps like more of these spectacle types of his films.
Well, I think that, look, without a doubt, the films from the 50s are all masterpieces.
Oh, yeah,
just down the line. Just one after another, after another, after another. I mean, he really had gotten to the full mastery over his skill set.
Yeah.
And I do think that he, I even think The Wrong Man.
I love The Wrong Man.
I think it's a masterpiece. I think that I love Dial M for Murder, and I think that movie on, every film up through The Birds is a masterpiece. Yeah. I'm a little bit less inclined to call Marnie that. I know there are a lot of people who love to champion Marnie, and good on them, because there's certainly a lot of interesting things in that film. But I feel like indisputably from Dial M for Murder through The Birds, each film is just masterful in terms of the way the stories are told. But I think it's really interesting to look at a filmmaker's work early on and see the developing ideas, and certainly Stage Fright fits within that. I think it's probably closest in tone to a film like Young and Innocent from this British period, which I also think is a wonderfully underrated film, which I enjoy more than The Lady Vanishes or The 39
Steps. I still have to see that. That's one of the
films. Yeah, no, it's a great film. Yeah, and I think that, again, it's a film that really captures a lot of these themes that he's interested in, and also this balance between humor and suspense. But I think that if you're going to take an artist seriously, and certainly I do think that Hitchcock was an artist, You have to really examine the things that he was trying and maybe not completely successfully rendering to really understand some of the later work.
Right.
And as I said, I think that Stage Fright in many ways prefigures some of the later films in terms of the relationships and in terms of the idea of somebody presenting themselves one way and then being something else. Certainly the ideas of projection that are throughout his later films, the idea of people projecting onto others, qualities that they see that may or may not have anything to do with the actual person.
Saw that in everything he did after this, up till Family Plot even.
And I think that's really a key to understanding a lot of these films, because I think if you view it that way, I get irritated when I hear people just focus on one film and try to deconstruct it as and this is the final word on that. I'm like, well, there's a thousand ways to circumambulate any of these films.
Right.
And I think that there is a dialogue back and forth between these films and others that he made, and also films that other people were making around him. Like, I think there's real echoes in this film. I know that Hitchcock was a fan of Billy Wilder.
Right.
It is my hunch. You know, I don't know this. I've never seen this in print anywhere, but it's my hunch that he saw Marlene Dietrich in Billy Wilder's film, A Foreign Affair, and was inspired to use her in this film because of that film. That film had been made a couple of years prior.
Yeah,
I'm sure he saw it. I know he liked Wilder's work. I'm sure he saw it, and I'm sure he had the idea of designing, you know, a big musical number for her based upon what he saw her do in that film. I think those kinds of discussions oftentimes get overlooked in the desire to just explicate one film, you know.
Right.
And you can't talk about Suspicion without talking about Rebecca before it.
Of course, you
can't talk about the way that those female characters developed through that whole Joan Harrison period without really examining all of the films that they worked on together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a real development of not just the characters but the ideas behind the characters, and I find that to be one of the most enjoyable things about being a Hitchcock fan is seeing that progression of thought.
Yes.
And I certainly carry that over my own work. I mean, I'm always, you know, I enjoy looking at, you know, what is it that I learned from this experience that I can carry into this experience,
right,
this new experience, and in what way can I expand on the various ideas that I've been exploring over here in this new creative,
yes,
endeavor over here.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I enjoy most about working in this business.
Mm-hmm.
Is that possibility.
Can you talk about what you're working on now? Is that
I'm shooting an episode of NCIS Hawaii. It's a new show. They just got their back order, and I'm doing the first episode of the back order. So it's episode 14 of the first season. Start shooting next Thursday. So
nice.
This being, I don't know when you're posting this, but this being November 13th. So I start shooting, next Thursday. And
okay,
I'm really enjoying being in Hawaii, and I'm enjoying working with the people that I'm working with. It's some of the people I've worked with before. The showrunner, Jan Nash, was a woman I worked with on Rizzoli and Isles, and I did a lot of episodes of that show, and really enjoy working with her. She's just a total pleasure, consummate showrunner. So I'm happy to be here.
Great.
And then my show, Sweet Magnolias, that I have worked on, a show I'm a producer on as well. That show, the second season of that, will drop early next year on Netflix, and so I'm excited about that, and very hopeful that we'll get a third season. So
great. Exciting stuff. Well, best of luck with the show, and
thank you.
With this, all that you're working on, Sweet Magnolias, I'm looking forward to that. And I know that you're also on Twitter and Instagram as well. So
yeah,
I will.
Yeah.
You got quite the following.
it's interesting. I do appreciate the social media outlets, because I do have people who have followed me from show to show, and it's a very strange phenomenon, social media. There's a lot about it. It has its light and its dark side for sure, but I've had some just really wonderful, interesting relationships grow out of social media.
Yeah.
And I'm very grateful. I mean, my relationship with Joel Guns, who
right,
invited me to be part of HitchCon, was started on social media. And I'm really grateful for that aspect of it. And I'm grateful for the opportunity through social media to explore a lot of these various things that we're even talking about, because
exactly.
I try to use it.
Yeah.
I try to use it in a way to share with people what I think is important and what I love, and certainly have appreciated the fact that I do have a following that has remained very loyal in terms of what I do, the work I do. And I'm grateful for that. So, yeah, you know, so Yeah, people can follow me at Norbuck, N-O-R-B-U-C-K.
Awesome. So. Okay, great. Well, I'll leave the link in the description box below for where you can follow Norman. And for those of you here for the first time on my YouTube channel, there's also an audio version of the podcast, and it's available on all of the different platforms. Not everything that's on the YouTube channel is on the audio version. So if you want to hear more or watch more, head over to the YouTube channel to see a lot more discussions with various people on various films. And just lastly, if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing. It's absolutely free to do so by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You'll see it floating above my head right here to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release one of my new videos or when I go live. Norman, thanks again. And I hope you can come on again to talk either another Hitchcock or any other film.
Yeah, sure. I'd love that. That'd be fun.
Okay, great. And we'll see everybody in the next episode.